Thanks for choosing the Breaking Ground podcast. Stay tuned for a fun and informative episode about carbon capture, storage, and the future of energy in the UK.
At Central Piling, we have a fleet of continuous flight auger, rotary board, and driven rigs of various sizes. This caters for most piling and retaining wall needs. Our team's technical, logistical, and operational strengths provide clients with a flexible and reliable design and build solution across England and Wales. We pride ourselves on understanding the environment within which we work and being a responsible contractor. To ensure greater efficiency and meet our growth targets, we are always developing our people, plant, and services. We now offer a plant and operator hire service, including ancillary equipment. For more details, please visit centralpiling.com or phone 01787 474 000. That's 01787 474 000.
Today on the podcast, I'm joined by Carla Martin-Clave from Jacobs. Carla is an engineering geologist. She previously studied and did a PhD at the University of Nottingham. Carla, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Thank you very much.
You're off to Spain last time we spoke.
Yeah. I was off to Barcelona. I'm from Barcelona. Yeah, great weather, great food as well.
I saw an amazing picture actually of Barcelona the other day, and it was from the air. And I didn't realise what a grid system it was. I've been a couple of times, but on stag do, so I probably wasn't paying too much attention. it's just incredible view. And of course, the big church.
Yeah, Sagrada Familia. Yeah.
Still going. When are they going to finish that?
Good question. So the thing is that they should have finished already, but well, they keep delaying the final dates when they are going to finish it. But now I think the final date, the deadline is going to be 2026, maybe the latest 2030. Wow. And yeah, in the last years, they've been doing a lot of improvement from finishing some of the towers, the most important towers, and then just putting the last details and saying like, this tower is finished, we're gonna now finish the next tower. And yeah, I think they are very close to get it completely finished.
Oh, finally. That'd be nice to see it in my lifetime. It's like 100 years, isn't it? They've been building it. It's something crazy.
Yeah. I think it's been a little bit more than 100 years now. And it actually is very interesting to, when you look in the internet pictures about when did they started like building the Sagrada Familia, you can see the pictures and there's nothing around Sagrada Familia. You can see that you started putting the foundations and everything around surrounding the Sagrada Familia is just fields. It's very bizarre to see this image from Barcelona. Like, what? Right now, Sagrada Familia is in the middle of the city. And when you look at those pictures at the very beginning, when they started, it's like there's nothing. Everything you can see are fields. And it's like, it's quite shocking seeing how different it looks since they started.
Yeah. I think when you get these iconic buildings, it brings so much more with it. The community. Yeah. Be a stimulus for growth. And we've got a similar thing around Wembley, actually, like the new Wembley Stadium. Now, like that whole area. I know it's not like...
I love how you compare a football stadium with a cathedral. Yeah. It might be all for right, some people, it? Their religion, you know, football.
Yeah, exactly. So you've come to prominence in the last year or so within the industry, largely through your award, the Glossop Award. And the Glossop Award is an annual award for young engineers provided by the engineering group of the Geological Society. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about the award and what your entry was?
So this is an award, the Geological, as you very well said, it's given by the engineering group from the Geological Society. And the award is, it has two versions. Well, it has two. One of the versions is for young professionals. So just trying to to extend a little bit or to put in knowledge of everyone the work that young professionals are doing nowadays. And then they recognize as well the work that senior professionals have been doing for a long time in all these years. They have been dedicating as well to the engineering geology. So there are two prizes that they give, one for young professionals and the other one for senior professionals that have been dedicating a lot of years to the engineering geology. So in my case this year, the topic was about the role of engineering geology in the energy transition. And the way how this prize works is you have to submit an application. The reason why I decided to submit an application is because within Jacobs, they encouraged me to submit an application because I do a lot of volunteering work related to the energy transition. I collaborate with the European Association of Geoscientists and Engineers.
Sorry, the terminology there, energy transition, I presume that you're talking about the transition away from fossil fuels to...
Yeah, this is the idea. Energy. So the by energy transition, we put understand that this step-by-step transition from a system based in fossil fuels to a system based in renewable energies and cleaner sources of energy. Obviously, we say it's the energy transition, like it's being done step by step, because nowadays we don't have the necessary infrastructure to deliver the amount of energy we need day by day to run countries, economies. We still don't have this infrastructure to deliver this energy all from renewable sources. So this is why we are now in the position of starting delivering all these cleaner energies and to replace step by step the power stations delivering power from fossil fuels. But it's going to be a transition, a slow transition, because there is still a lot of amounts of investment that has to be done, and as well training and identifying the right skills to deliver this energy.
And of course, we've been in a fuel crisis due to the war in the Ukraine. So that's kind of raised this upper level in importance again, as if climate change wasn't a big enough issue in itself. There is an area of expertise that you've already found through your PhD with this, which is around storage solutions. So to store energy in specifically salt caverns. Can you tell us a little bit more about where these salt caverns are found, specifically in the UK, and what they're made of, how the salt is taken out, and why that is useful for storage?
Well, salt caverns have been historically used already for several years. So it's a technology that has been already well demonstrated, and it's been proven that it's a very good resource using salt caverns to store hydrogen and liquids. The main reason why we use salt caverns is because from the oil and gas industry, it's been demonstrated as well that rock salt, can work as a very good seal in petroleum systems. So it has a very low permeability, and obviously it has no porosity, so very low permeability. So it's very good to be used as a sealing material to storage either gas or liquids. And here in the UK, we have two different resources of rock salt. It would be the Triassic in Cheshire Basin, and then the Permian rock salt, the Zexting rock salt that we share with other countries in Europe. And the Zexting group, the Permian rock salt, is located in the east coast of the UK, and more specifically around Grimsby area in Teesside, actually is in Teesside. And there are already some salt caverns being operated in Teesside for the industry and to store even natural gas, hydrogen, and as well chemicals for the industry. And yeah, those are the main resources for salt caverns here in the UK.
Okay, so that's probably quite a raft of questions actually from the what you've just said. So the rock salt, that, am I right in saying that's also known as halite?
Yeah.
But a lot of these mines, you won't just have the halite, you'll also have polyhalite, which is made up of presumably rock salt, but mixed in with other materials, which often is why these mines exist in the first place, because I don't know whether there would be enough money in it to just create these mines for gas storage solutions. You know, there are other ways of doing it. In fact, my business is currently working on the Isle of Grain on a liquid natural gas storage facility, and I know that the capacity for gas storage, you know, there's a real drive to increase that, because we've got, when you compare us with the rest of Europe, we've got a really low storage capacity. I did find a statistic, which is, it's about a year out of date, but probably still quite relevant, that the UK has got something like 9 days of gas storage, whereas Germany's got 89, France has got 103. So we're really poorly resourced for gas storage of whichever type. You know, we'll go on to talk about different types of gas, but our storage capacity certainly needs to increase. So the project in Grimsby, am I right in saying that was a polyhalite mine?
Well, yeah, this is the thing. So we have some halite in Teesside, but it's mainly, it's the main place to produce polyhalite in the UK. So this is one of the challenges we get when working with salt caverns, because polyhalite tends to be, well, to have a completely different behavior, more brittle behavior under certain temperatures and pressures compared to halite. And actually, this is what I worked with during my PhD thesis. My PhD thesis, I had to do some research about how different evaporitic minerals would behave under certain temperatures and pressures compared to halites. And those temperatures and pressures are being related to operations of gas storage. And what I could say is that second mineralogies like anhydrite and polyhalite were behaving in a more brittle way under cyclic mechanical loading that can be applied to gas storage operations. By cyclic mechanical loading, I mean that in my mechanical testing, I wasn't applying a continuous pressure load on my samples. I was cycling this load. And something I saw as well is that since I was cycling this mechanical loading, I could see an accumulation of damage that was worsening as well the mechanical integrity of the rock salt, and as well promoting the development of microfractures.
Right. It must have been quite difficult to replicate what would actually happen in the mine in the laboratory, but I suppose there's no way to do a full-scale test, really, is there?
Actually, in the mine environment. It's always quite difficult to replicate real conditions in the lab scale. But in my case, for example, I was focusing, I applied different confining pressures to simulate different depths. And then I just reproduced the temperatures and the cyclic pressures that we can have in salt caverns linked to the activities of hydrogen storage. One of the problems I faced while doing my PhD is that I only had 3 years to write down my thesis. And for this reason, I had to apply these pressure conditions in a higher way, higher speed than normally. So, for example, my test was running for 48 hours, whereas in normal conditions, when we are applying we are operating salt caverns, that can get, it's going to be based on a seasonal activity. So maybe we can have fluctuations of pressures as spread in different months. And in my case, I was bringing the samples to the edge, to the worst case scenario, because I wanted to see what the worst case scenario could be affecting my rocks, how it would be affecting my rocks. And then because I didn't really have a lot of time to test a lot of samples.
Yeah, but you're talking there about microfracture, and at a small scale level, I guess the salt, the rock can perform in one way, but when you're talking about huge caverns and voids, maybe the behavior as a mass changes slightly. you talk a little bit about maybe the scale effects and how you looked at the arching of not just a small particle, but the whole group.
Yeah, that's true, actually. In my case, I had to focus all my research at the microscale level, because obviously at the lab level, it tends to be, microscope level rather than macro scale level. But the good thing I want to think about, I want to think that at least the results I got now that explain a little bit more the formation mechanism of at a microscale scale level could be applied for numerical modeling to see what can happen at a macro scale level. So this is the second part. My former supervisor from the BGS is still expecting me to deliver. So the first part was all based in lab results, and this is what I was publishing from my PhD results. And the next level would be starting doing a little bit more numerical modeling to see what happened at the macro scale level.
Yeah, that'd be quite an interesting model to develop. So do you make approximations with I'm just imagining this model of a cavern in some sort of three-dimensional Plaxis software program. Do you go in there, do like a survey, electronic survey of the whole cavern, and then somehow upload that to a program? Or are you just saying, right, it's 10 meters by 20 meters deep by...
Well, it depends if you have a case study to look at. So for example, if I get to have a salt cavern to test, I would try to get first a sonic survey to get the shape of the salt cavern internally, and then you can use this the data from the sonic level to be uploaded in one of the programs, and then you can do the model, the numerical modeling with more detail from a real salt cavern. And if you don't have this, then you always can model your own salt cavern. You can create a shape for your salt cavern. And then after having the shape of your salt cavern, you're going to be setting what's the geology around this salt cavern. If you have only halite, pure halite rock salt, or maybe you have other mineralogies interlying this rock salt formation, because this is very important to have in account as well to consider, because obviously other mineralogies such as sandstone are going to be deforming in a completely different way under the same temperature and pressure conditions. So for example, whereas halite tends to deform in a more ductile way, we have then the sandstone or mudstone, which are going to be deforming in a more brittle way. And it's very important to put the focus in these other mineralogies to see if there is any risk of those rock formations of delivering or developing fractures that could be putting risk the tightness of the salt cavern.
So presumably the polyhalites are more varied than the halite, and therefore more difficult to predict what's going on.
Well, this is the thing. My research project was... The data from my research project was to, I could either interpret that the polyhalite was behaving in a more brittle way than halite, yes.
But that's because of the heterogeneous nature of that material.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, any other evaporitic minerals that might be interlying or just mixed with this halite has to be considered in this modeling, because they might imply different behavior or different risk for the mechanical integrity.
We're getting quite techie there, but I'd like to take a step back to actually how you get the salt out and the process involved. And I suppose people will be asking questions, you know, you're pitching this as something that is part of a low carbon future, but what is the environmental impact of these operations, of these mines? You know, whenever you're digging stuff out of the ground, clearly there is going to be an impact. have there been cases of damage to local infrastructure, people's houses, any accidents and incidents? What do you know about that? Maybe start off by talking about the process of extracting the
The prices, the cost of creating a salt cavern, this is going to depend on the purity of the rock salt, and that's going to have to be decided, let's say, during the designing process, because obviously we'll have to look at every case. We'll have to see what resources we have available, what is the rock formation we are looking at, what's the extension of this rock formation, what's the thickness as well of this rock formation, and then based on these parameters, the composition of the rock salt formation, then the thickness, the extension, this will help us to determine how big our salt cavern is going to be, or how many salt caverns can we host in the same rock formation. The next step we're going to do, once we have decided, okay, we're going to have one big salt cavern, is when we have to do all the drilling, and then we create the salt cavern by pumping water underground, and then we dissolve the halite, and then we withdraw all this brine, and this brine is gonna go to a pond, and obviously later we have to do some kind of management of this brine. So that I would say maybe this is the first constraint for environmental speaking, no? Like, what's the management? We have to do a very good management of this brine waste, let's say.
Is it waste, or is it a product that can be used? I mean, there's only so much salt you can put on your chips.
So the thing is that so far, I don't really know if it has other uses. I'm sure it can be used for something else, but I don't have the information about how to recycle this brine. I just know that this brine has to be managed. It's been deposited in this pond, and then there is a process of management for this brine. And I guess it will depend on the necessities of the region as well, and if they have services to reutilization of the brine or not. And then
in terms of the drill goes down, and then the high pressure water jets go through the middle of the drill,
you dissolve, and then, the cavern is artificial cavern, so we inject the water, we dissolve the halite, and then we pump out this water. And then, as you said, the other thing we need to monitor as well is, since we are creating a cavity underground, we have to monitor the ground subsidence, because we can have some problems, structural problems on the top, as you said, to other facilities, might be on the top roads or houses. They might experience some structural problems due to this ground subsidence. So something that we have to do during the production of the salt cavern, and as well after creating the salt cavern and for years of operations, we need to do a good monitoring of the ground subsidence. Because obviously, if we start having ground subsidence, might mean that either we have a problem of mechanical integrity of the salt cavern, or we are not using the right operation pressures in the salt cavern. So actually, this monitoring process is very important to let us know what's happening inside the salt cavern as well.
Yeah, I think people will maybe be comparing and contrasting this with something like shale gas extraction, and the concerns around that about groundwater pollution and vibrations. How would you contrast those two techniques?
So, for example, the other problem that obviously you mentioned right now is that it's very important to ensure the tightness of the salt cavern, because if we have a leak, that leak can deal to contamination of aquifers, which are resources for water, for public resources for water, and we want to avoid this as well. But this is why there is a lot of monitoring of the salt caverns. It's the monitoring of the ground subsidence, and as well seismic activity, just to know if there is anything going wrong within the salt cavern. And although obviously the risk is there, the industry have a lot of experience right now, by now, after several years of operating soil caverns. And there's been a lot of data now to learn as well from previous cases of maybe risking like leaks or how to prevent those leaks happening and contaminating other land. Yeah.
So who are the people funding these sorts of projects? Are they big conglomerates? Is it the mining company that sees an opportunity to rent some storage space to a gas company? Or is the potential so big for the gas company that they're the ones leading and owning the project?
Okay, so I don't really know much about it, but what I know, since in the projects I've been working with, we describe soil caverns as an asset. So normally those assets belong to someone, and it can be a private company or it can be maybe the government. So I would say it's normally more like a privately funded, unless it's maybe the government who wants to have some soil caverns to, for example, to be used as a strategic disposal of gas or a strategic gas storage for example, to fill the demand, to meet the demand during the winter. This is something that a lot of governments do during the summer when the natural gas has a lower price. The governments buy this natural gas and they store it somewhere in assets, like, for example, soil caverns. And then they have this, let's say, cheaper natural gas to face the challenges during the winter. But yeah, it can be either the government wanted to run soil caverns for strategic storage, or companies wanted to store their own chemicals, or companies wanted to provide the service of storing chemicals or gas or any liquid for other clients in the industry. But normally they are more like recognized as assets, so it's more like private. Yeah.
Sure. Well, if the government's not funding it already, then they should certainly begin giving it some serious consideration, because as we touched on earlier, we are very vulnerable in terms of our capacity. Yeah. So initially, at least, we're looking at this as a storage resource for liquid natural gas. But of course, we're moving on to, as you mentioned, other green energy types. LNG is going to be a fossil fuel. Whereas something like hydrogen, we can look at as a renewable. And I think we've seen the problems with electric cars in terms of range capacity, refueling. Hydrogen power for vehicles seems to be something that's becoming more and more in favour. And if we're going to look at that as a fuel resource, then we've obviously got to increase our capacity for that. Yep. As well. I don't know the sort of volumes we're talking about, but presumably the mines could be used just as effectively for hydrogen, liquid hydrogen, as they could for...
Well, the thing is that liquid hydrogen is a way of transporting the liquid hydrogen, but when we store it in soil caverns, it's in gas, because the conditions we have within the soil caverns, the temperatures we have there and the pressures, it's normally the gas, the hydrogen is in gas state. But yeah, it's true that I know that in the network, in the pipeline, a pipeline network, normally it's transported as a liquid state. And then, yeah, just because I think, sorry, it's just because I heard that twice, just to make sure that, well, people understand that in the soil cavern, we are going to be storing it as a gas. But then, for example, the reason why I say liquid is because we can store as well oil or other liquid chemicals, for example. But yeah, it's It's very funny what you said about, well, it's interesting, sorry, what you said about the hydrogen, because
I'm never funny.
the thing is that it's true that we've heard about hydrogen economy and we've seen a lot of reports going on from the government releasing like a strategic report about hydrogen economy in the UK. And what we've seen is that there is a lot of planning, there is a lot of talking. But the truth is that the discussion is open. So we've heard that the hydrogen could play a very important role in the decarbonization of the UK and even the decarbonization of the industry and as well the energy system in Europe. But everything is still on the table, because I think the energy transition is going to be more related to the necessities of different regions. I have the feeling that in the last, well, the last decade, our energy system has been very centralized, and sometimes it's difficult to meet necessities for very isolated areas. And maybe the energy transition now, it's an opportunity to decentralize this energy system and create, and find solutions for every different region. Like, let's say, if there is a region who has a lot of sources of geothermal energy, maybe we should look into exploring what's the capacity of energy production from those geothermal resources. And if we have another region with a lot of sand, like for example in Spain, maybe we should look at the potential of using this solar capacity for energy for energy production. Or for example, the UK has been now investing a lot of money in producing energy from wind energy. And I think it's a very good idea.
Approaching 40% we're looking at. I could be slightly wrong with my figures there, but up to 40% wind energy. Geothermal is an interesting one. There's a big geothermal plant down in Cornwall. In fact, I'd love to have, I'm trying to think of the name of the guy that runs it now, but I'd love to have him on as a podcast guest to tell us a little bit more about that. I don't know what it is about exactly about the geology in Cornwall, but it seems like it's well suited to a project there, but maybe not as transferable to other parts of the UK. But
yeah, it's more like igneous rocks in Cornwall, I think. And I know I've been working a little bit with the geology there, not a lot, just a little bit. And what I know, I don't know, because I haven't visited yet, but I think you have a lot of thermal activity in Bath. So it looks like this side of the country might be a good choice for to invest some money in seeing how the geothermal energy could be providing some resources in this side of the country, maybe.
And plenty of jobs for geotechnical engineers. Engineers and geologists, yeah. As you touched on, you're a well-travelled woman. How do you see the energy mix and the use of salt caverns around the globe? Is this something that is unique to the UK, or are other people already doing this successfully?
No, we have other people doing it. And the thing is that obviously salt caverns are very limited to the regions where they have rock salt resources. And so, for example, we can find some salt caverns in the United States and in the coast of the Gulf Coast as well. We can see a lot of rock salt resources in dome structures and we know they have some salt caverns there being operated. Then we have other options, like for example in Poland they have as well the Zexting group and the Netherlands as well. And actually salt caverns have been operated now for a lot of years, and as well in the United States and China as well, they have some resources for salt caverns. I've seen some papers coming from China, very interesting ones. So actually it's a well-known technology that we can apply for the energy transition. And I think the salt caverns that have been used for so long now to store natural gas, will play a very important role in the future. If we repurpose the salt caverns into the hydrogen storage, but for energy storage. So for example, hydrogen can be considered an energy carrier. With that, I would suggest that we I'm suggesting that we synthesize this hydrogen only when we have an excedent of energy in the grid, in the electricity grid, for example, in the electric grid, when we have an excedent of energy or electricity and no one is going to be using, then that would be free resource to use to create hydrogen from electrolysis, for example. And in that way, if we use it with this concept of using electricity that no one is going to be using otherwise, is when we talk about energy carrier. We are creating this hydrogen just as a way of storing this electricity no one is going to be using. And then once we use this energy, this excedent of energy, then we can store the hydrogen we've produced in the salt caverns. And that would be a way of energy storage. I'm saying that because I have concerns about people coming to me and telling me, yeah, but Carla, hydrogen is very interesting, but it's very expensive to produce. Do you really think it's going to be playing an important role in the energy transition? Is yes, I do believe hydrogen will play an important role. But I agree, it's quite expensive product to produce right now, but it can be more effective if we produce it when we have an excedent of energy. This energy that if we don't use it otherwise, it's going to be wasted. So I think this is the right way of using hydrogen for energy, for the energy system, I think. Because then if we try to replace natural gas with hydrogen, we have the problem as well that we are going to have to invest a lot of money in transforming the gas network, because we have to adapt this gas network to hydrogen. And secondly, transforming the houses, the households, because they are now running the central heating in the houses with boilers for natural gas. And it's going to be a great big investment replacing all the boilers to be used with hydrogen.
Yeah, I know we're looking at a lot of air source heat pumps these days as well, which I'd like to see put into all new houses. I think we miss an opportunity when we're so desperate in this country to build new homes. Sometimes we forget that this is really a fantastic opportunity to raise the bar in terms of insulation. There is some work and the planning guidelines are changing, but it all seems too slow. You know, we could be doing so much more. You look at other countries and they insist on having a geothermal borehole for every development, or insist on having solar panels on every roof. Why aren't we doing these sorts of things? Just want to come back to the idea of mines as storage resources. People might not have been aware of the concept of salt mines in this way in the past, but they will be aware of other mines, coal mines, copper, tin, all of which are peppered around the UK. And there's times where they've been backfilled with grout. Is there an opportunity there in those sorts of conditions to use those as storage facilities?
Yeah. So, for example, I've heard about a project, well, using depleted, well, mines, shaft mines, rock salt, halite mines that now they are depleted, no one are using, but the shafts are still there. And I think what they wanted to do was like placing like a weight there and using the gravity forces to generate energy. So what you do is the same way of a store. Well, it's a way of storing energy from the electric grid. So when we have a lot of energy available, we have an excedent of energy available, then we can lift a weight. We use this energy to lift this weight, and then we hold it on top. And the day we don't have energy and we want to produce some energy, we just lift this, we let this weight go, and with this gravity forces that it's going to be attracted, okay. It's going to fall by itself, it generates electricity and it can give it back to the grid. So that would be other way of energy storage as well. And that would be using, for example, shaft mines, because we have those very high shaft mines that are not being used anymore. So maybe we can implement these kind of technologies to store energy in this way. As I said, it's not like a big way of energy storage, but it can be a solution for a certain regions, small villages.
Yes, or similar sort of concept to hydropower.
Yeah,
so there's places in Scotland where there's like a lake at the top of the mountain, and like you say, when you need some energy, the water comes through in terms of turbines, creates electricity, yep. and then when there's low demand, and energy that would have just been wasted, you pump it back up. Just specifically around the storage of gas within a coal mine, would that work, or is it because of the porosity of coal, it wouldn't be effective in the same way that salt is?
Okay, my first concern about using a coal mine is obviously first the geology. I don't think the geology is as appropriate as rock salt, for example, which is more, it has a higher tyness and less permeability. We should first look into what's the geology in this coal mine, for example. And then my second concern is that I don't think the mine was never designed with the purpose of being reused for gas storage. Obviously, I would say we should look at every different case, but I don't know if the repurposing of coal mines would be the most appropriate for gas storage. I cannot tell completely, because obviously we should look at different every single case to see if it's appropriate or not. I haven't worked yet with this kind of repurposing of a coal shaft, for example, in a coal mine. I've heard about the other projects, like using other technologies to repurposing all those infrastructures. Because in the end, I mean, they are big shafts underground. Hopefully we can reuse. I've heard as well something about repurposing the coal mines for geothermal exploration. Yeah, for geothermal energy. And actually, this is something I remember being once at the British Geological Survey. They were presenting this proposal, like using repurposing coal mines for geothermal energy. And one of the things, because I was working with cyclic mechanical loading conditions and seeing how that was affecting the rock salt. So one of the things I thought to propose as a way of research was looking at the temperature and pressure oscillations in the geothermal activity within the coal mine, and see how these changes in temperatures, injecting and withdrawing, could affect as well the integrity of the rocks in the mine. And I just proposed this because it was obviously what I was looking at with the rock salt. But I've heard about this kind of projects, about repurposing coal mines for geothermal energy. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like we might have to get you back on in a couple of years when you've investigated a few more of these projects. What's next for you at the moment, Carla? You've obviously come out of the academic world, and you're at home there at Jacobs. What exciting things are on the horizon?
Well, the exciting things on the horizon right now is that from Jacobs, for example, we are trying to deliver all the different energy projects that the government is wanting. Well, right now, as I said, everything is on the table. So it's a very exciting moment to be involved with the energy transition, because everything is on the table and it's call for proposals. It's like a never-ending call for proposals. The government is encouraging everyone to come up with solutions and different technologies and different techniques for energy storage, for example. And this is how we've started seeing those kind of projects using any type, like, for example, the weight dropping technique for energy storage or energy production. And it's a very, very exciting moment right now to be involved with the energy transition. And right now, for me, I'm expecting to get more involved with hydrogen, the hydrogen economy, and how soil caverns can provide an important role, like, and can be an important role, can play an important role in the hydrogen storage framework. So I keep working, trying to find the opportunities in the solution mining industry, such as the soil caverns. And right now, yeah, I've got to work with two different projects related to soil caverns, always in the United States. It looks like the United States is right now doing a lot more work related to soil caverns. But yeah, I expect to be working still with rock salt and soil caverns, and as well energy storage.
Fantastic. And one last question from me. For anybody that's listening, that's considering entering the Glossop Award this year, what words of advice have you got for them?
Apply. Because obviously at the beginning, within Jacobs, they suggest me to apply for this Glossop Award. At the beginning, I thought I didn't know if that was for me or if I could be eligible to apply for this award. And then I would say I would be applying to the topic of interest. So the reason why I decided to apply last year was because it was for the energy transition. So I felt confident about applying to this award and showing what is the work I've been doing, because I've been working a lot with the energy transition. Some people at Jacob, some colleagues, they ask me, like, I'd like to apply as well one day. What do you recommend me? And I would say, just keep doing whatever you are passionate about, apply, keep working on your expertise, and then once you feel very confident, I'm sure you can apply to this award and you can share all your expertise with the rest of the world, even if you are just a young professional.
Great advice. Thanks, Carla. Great chatting to you.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Please do get in touch with suggestions and feedback with me, Steve Hadley, via LinkedIn. Bye-bye.